For today's panel, we're very pleased to have Stacy Allen as moderating. He spoke at the midwinter meeting in Austin and hosted the panel there on video games. There's going to be a little bit different slant on it today, but it was a great presentation, and we're looking forward to this. And we'll introduce he'll introduce the other speakers momentarily. And just a quick thanks to Rose Auslander and David Donahue for helping name the event, and you can blame them for the title of this event. And let me turn it over to Stacy. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Before we start, I wanted to introduce the other panel members that we're very fortunate to have with us today. So starting at the other end of the table, Brian Pine is the Director of Legal Affairs and Enforcement for the Entertainment Software Rating Board, where his duties include investigating enforcement matters, negotiating agreements, maintaining a trademark portfolio, and assisting in policy development. Prior to joining the ESRB, Brian was Associate Counsel at Take-Two, where he negotiated agreements, reviewed game assets, and advised on a variety of issues pertaining to game development and publishing. Next to him is Monica Corton, who is Vice President of Creative Affairs and Licensing at Next Decade Entertainment. Her responsibilities include all creative exploitation of Next Decade's works, as well as licensing works published and administered by the company, including the music of the band Boston, which, if you're old enough to have been around then, you're very familiar with, and as she pointed out, have become familiar with through the game Guitar Hero. And then sitting immediately next to me is my colleague, Emilio Nicholas, from our Austin office at Jackson Walker, whose practice includes intellectual property and general commercial litigation, entertainment and media transactions, and IP rights management. And I am a litigation commercial and IP litigator in our Jackson Walker's Austin, Texas office. So let's get going. We have a lot to cover today. Used successfully in Texas, so we're going to try it again here, a hypothetical game which we have created that we're going to take from development all the way through expansion and use the game to sort of illustrate some of the concepts that we wanted to touch on and which have been preoccupying the courts in the past year or two. So if you read along with me, and it's only two slides at the beginning, so hopefully this isn't too painful. You are legal counsel to Tortious Entertainment, a video game company. TE is developing its newest game, Grand Theft Robot. In Grand Theft Robot, the player takes on the role of a cyborg, human on the outside, machine on the inside, who has come from the distant future to the fictional locale of Boilerplate City. His mission is to take control of the city and thus the future by rising through the ranks of the criminal underground. The game is a dark satire of American urban culture and is rife with adult content and violent themes that are made realistic by 3D-like graphics and gruesome sound effects. Whoops. The player chooses various missions given to him by local crime bosses, which the player must complete to progress through the main storyline. These missions involve assassinations, armed robberies, car chases, and injuring innocent bystanders and law enforcement until the player's avatar is busted by law enforcement or escapes. Since the player can determine the missions that he wants to undertake, his gaming experience can change based on the choices he makes. And here's our jacket art for the game. Brian, this might be a good point to ask. Might TE have done well by doing a trademark search before they developed this title?
Yeah. Generally speaking, you want to do a thorough trademark search. I know this isn't the audience for trademark, but it overlaps by a lot. Doing a thorough trademark search before you decide on the naming of your game is probably a good idea. For a little more reading, if you're interested in that, you can look into the dispute between Bethesda Interactive and Mojang regarding use of the word scrolls in a video game title, which I believe Bethesda actually has trademarked in connection with their Elder Scrolls games. But yeah, Grand Theft, there may be some players who've already looked into that for a video game title. Oh, sorry. Thorough trademark searches. You're going to want to do them before deciding on a video game title. Sorry about that.
So now we're going to modify our hypo as we go along and add a new layer to discuss. So in the first of these, in focus group testing, not surprisingly, nearly all the participants comment that GTR's gameplay features and functions are strikingly similar to the popular Grand Theft Auto video game franchise. When asked, GTR's design team readily concedes that Grand Theft Auto was not just the inspiration for GTR, but the blueprint, asking, dude, why reinvent the wheel? TE's CEO is not amused and wants to know if she should be concerned, which brings us to the cloning cases. And Emilio, maybe you can set the table for us with the two of the leading cases, and we'll take it from there.
Well, game cloning is defined as just as it sounds. It's when you've got, it's this recent practice coming out, you're seeing a lot in the mobile application market, where you have someone coming along that is basically cloning a classic video game of the past, bringing it into the new millennium. One big case was the continuing saga of Electronic Arts versus Zynga. The case that they had, we'll show you that case in a moment, though, that they just recently settled and dismissed over EA's The Sims game versus Zynga's game, The Ville. Here, though, we have a case from the District of New Jersey in 2012 that was decided involving the classic video game Tetris. And on the left, the images here, you'll see the original Tetris game. And on the right is a mobile app game developed by a small startup company called Zio. And the game was called Mino. And when Zio went out to develop this game, the record showed that Zio admitted that it had actually set out to create a Tetris-like game because the concept was popular. Everyone knows about it. And Zio even admitted to researching copyright law before bringing this game to market, and believed that it could actually copy any part of Tetris because everything it was copying was based on the rule of the game or a functional aspect of it. And so per the idea expression dichotomy, it would be most likely immune from liability. This, though, was despite testimony from Zio's own expert witness when deposed, who readily admitted that, yes, they went out and copied this game, but they could have copied this game and changed any aspects of the gameplay, the look and feel, the function, one of, you know, millions of different ways. So what we had here is a fairly verbatim copy of the original Tetris game. The only real difference, if you look closely, you'll see there's little dimples in some of the playing pieces. The court in New Jersey, though, went down, looked at the two works, and apparently applied a total concept and feel test, you know, which really just comes down to I know it when I see it. It did this as opposed to applying a different test, such as the Second Circuit's Altali test that you see a lot in copyright software cases, where you're actually analyzing, instead of the graphical display, the underlying source code. The court, in reviewing the two different works, held that there was infringement and said that there was such similarity between the visual expression of Tetris and Mino that it is akin to literal copying. And the court's reasoning was that while the mechanics and rule of a video game are not entitled to protection, the way in which they are expressed may be. The court not only analyzed the idea expression dichotomy between the two games, it also looked at the merger doctrine and sens affair. The court decided that the merger doctrine was inapplicable in this case, because, again, Zio's own expert witness had stated that there could have been a number of ways that they could have expressed a particular idea. So it wasn't the expression of the idea and weren't merged into one. The reason why sens affair didn't apply was because this game exists in a fanciful world. This isn't a real-world type of game. It's playing blocks falling on each other in a black grid area. This is a bit different than, next slide, from what happened in the Ville. This is the game I referred to earlier. On the left here, you have EA's game, The Sims, and on the right is Zagna's video game, The Ville. And if we go to the next slide, this is a comparison of the two games here. You've got scenes where players are in the kitchen, they're in the bathroom. The game itself is you take on the avatar who's just living in the real world. You're helping them build their home, build their career, move on in life, do day-to-day activities like cooking, working, using the restroom. There's the next slide. Even taking a shower or going through here the sleep sequence. I mean, just looking at the surface, there's a lot of similarity in there. So if you went with the ruling in the Zio case and applied the total concept look and feel test, there may be a chance of infringement here. But this case took place in California, and the case settled fairly quickly because there was a chance that I would theorize the court in that case would have applied the Ninth Circuit's extrinsic-intrinsic test for substantial similarity. Fairly similar, I think, to the abstractions test in that you're from the objective part of the test, you're basically itemizing everything in the two games that are similar to each other, and then applying and doing so in a very analytical approach, and then you're applying your idea, expression dichotomy, merger doctrine, all of that. And then once that's taken out, what you're left with, you'd ask if an objective, reasonable person would find that there is substantial similarity. If this was in another jurisdiction that maybe hasn't ruled yet on a video game type of case, they might follow the Second Circuit's Altoli test, too. And instead of even looking at the graphical displays, looked at the underlying source code. And if anyone here has litigated a software copyright infringement case before, you know how difficult and complicated and very tedious that kind of analysis can be, comparing the ones and the zeros next to each other to find if there's a substantial similarity there in the code. So the two takeaways, I think, from this are, one, if you're going to find yourself filing suit against someone for infringing your video game, you want to be very careful about the jurisdiction you're in, because using the Third Circuit's test, the look and feel concept, that makes the case a lot easier to prove for the plaintiff. Using something like the Altoli test or the Ninth Circuit's test, it can make it much more difficult. The other takeaway, too, is if you look at the Sims game here, this is existing in the story itself takes place more in the real world, much like two sports games. This is very similar to a Data East decision in the Ninth Circuit, where it was a lawsuit between two video games dealing with karate fighting matches. And there the court held that there was, even though they look very similar, the court held that there was no infringement, or at least the plaintiff couldn't sustain his burden of proving infringement, because at the end of the day, we're talking to the very basic graphics at the time. This is like 1988, 89, so you're still dealing with your 8-bit Nintendo system. But all the similarities between the two games just came down to the typical structure of a real-world karate match. Two combatants using very familiar or established karate moves. One referee, it's typical in karate matches, a very similar point system. So you end up with something that is very akin to a merger doctrine analysis, where you can't separate the expression. Well, let me rephrase that. There's only a limited number of ways to express the idea, so there shouldn't be a copyright protection for that. That's very different than from the Tetris case, which again existed in a fanciful world. So if you're going out to develop a game that's going to be similar to someone else's game, look more towards the real world than a made-up fanciful world.
Brian, Emilio mentioned Sens Affair. How does Sens Affair play into the analysis in the video game context?
Well, let's make sure I'm close enough. Basically, when you're working with a developer, you want to be able to explain to them the difference between elements that are common to games in that genre or common to that medium, the difference between that and kind of specific characters and plot lines that are specific to a game they're thinking of as an inspiration. Whereas looking at kind of a game like Grand Theft Robot, things that might be Sons of Pharaoh might be car chases, crime bosses, a third-person perspective as to where you see the character, because those are just common to a lot of urban adventure games like Just Cause, Grand Theft Auto, Saints Row, Sleeping Dogs. Off the top of my head, those are all games that have come out with that all share those elements just in the last 2 years. But really, there's also another side to that where if you're looking at a game that is a simpler game on like mobile platforms or possibly a flash-based game, there are things that it's not exactly Sans Affair, but it's more limitations set by the medium and the format, such as the technology that a game like Sims Social or The Ville might be running on, which might actually limit the ways you can portray a game, because for the engines that are used on like Facebook games, you can really only display three-dimensional space in a limited number of ways, which means that even though the portrayal of the three-dimensional space in those looks similar, there's only so many ways, that being 3D geometric shapes, that you can kind of display 3D space with that engine, such that that really can't be counted against them as copying, since it's one of the only ways it can be done. So it kind of becomes functional in that way. So it's kind of, you have to look at what's common and required among the medium and the genre and the format and kind of explain to your developers that there's a difference between that and borrowing wholesale, you know, plots and characters such as, you know, an adventurous brunette who raids tombs in exotic locales. That's obviously not the same as just borrowing, you know, crime bosses and car chases, that kind of thing. So it's, there's a little explanation that you could give to your developers to kind of guide them in their development so that they don't run into these kind of issues.
Mobile device apps probably have graphic limitations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, mobile device apps, Facebook apps. There's a lot of limitations as far as, I mean, the limitations are getting less and less every day as the technology advances, but at present, if you want apps to run at a certain speed on certain platforms, you have limitations as to what they can look like, particularly if you're working on websites or on a Flash game. There's only certain ways you can get a Flash game to look and for it to still be run and to be technologically feasible. So you can always keep that in mind if that's a limitation that causes it to at least be similar in its initial appearance to some other games.
Okay, let's add another layer. GTR's design team is stoked about some game features they have designed to enhance the realism and interactive quality of the playing experience. So let's look at them. These are things the design guys say, hey, we know how to do this. Theme music, which would play whenever a player's avatar is driving the car in the Grand Theft Auto mode, selected from 100 preloaded genre-appropriate songs. Another would be mood music that plays automatically when an avatar enters a nightclub, a bar, a restaurant, or some other venue. Another might be a music mix radio stations, which players could select when driving their virtual cars, like All Kanye All the Time. Auto make and model selection. You know, you could offer Bentleys, Escalades, Ferraris, cars you might expect to see in a game like this to drive. Even choice of beverage in the cup holder. You know, Coke, Budweiser, Red Bull. And finally, you could allow the players to customize their avatars with preloaded clothing features, like T-shirts from popular concerts, name brand sneakers or shoes. Panel, will the suits say no as usual? Monica, you want to talk a little bit about some of those music issues?
Well, hopefully the suits won't say no to music, because I think music is proving to be a really viable part of video games and a driver in sales in a lot of ways. And I guess on the face of it, if you were kind of looking at the context of what this game is, and you had somebody maybe advising you on your music choices, you'd think maybe rock, hip-hop, and rap would sort of be the specific areas that people would think. But from a licensing standpoint, I might advise that you might want to lay off some of the rap and hip-hop, primarily because there's so many publishers involved in those games. For example, last year we had a huge hit song with Pitbull, a song called Shake Sonora, that sampled a song we published called Jump in the Line, which is owned by Harry Belafonte. And we have the largest percentage of that song, But there are five other co-publishers that own it with us. So if you want to clear that one song for this game, you have to talk to seven different companies. That's kind of labor intensive. So even though rap and hip hop might be a good genre, musically, you could stretch that out into other things. So maybe you want to think about the rock part being classic rock, hard rock, heavy metal, southern rock, jam band rock, like Widespread Panic and String Cheese Incident. Jam bands would love to be in video games and probably would be much easier licensees than, say, Led Zeppelin. And the variety of the music, you know, if you, you know, you should have a reggae component for those days when you're just not feeling so heavy metal, and maybe a funk component with people like Carl Denson and George Porter. Again, indie artists would love to be involved in video games. And then, you know, punk, Green Day, Sex Pistols kind of stuff. But the variety of music will also keep people playing the game longer and be more engaged and be more talkative about how cool the game is. And the rooms part of the game, which we sort of haven't fleshed out exactly how people would experience those rooms, but I don't know, say you do the robbery and then you want to go have a drink at a bar, those rooms could be thematic rooms, like the All Kanye room, or you could have them be artist-driven rooms where you somehow co-partner with a label that wants to promote a new artist or promote a pre-existing popular artist. Or you could have rooms where every song in the room has the word white in it, or there's so many varieties of how you could do it, as long as you keep within the base of these 100 songs that you've pre-cleared. But you have to figure out what these features are really clearly when you go to ask for the licensing, because the functionality of how the music works in the game is something the publisher is going to ask you for. So if you want to clear, you know, song A, let's just say More Than a Feeling, it's a song I represent, you want to make sure that you're telling them More Than a Feeling could be used as a theme song for the character. It could be used in the course of one of the venues as a background music in a room. It could be used on the radio station where, you know, we have the all classic rock station when a person is driving in the car. You just need to really flesh out how the music's used and in every way and explain that in the licensing. And as you can imagine, that can be a complicated system for you and your client who are, you know, an attorney and a video game person trying to figure out how do we make this palpable to a music publisher. So what I really would like to emphasize today is that you advise your clients to start hiring music consultants, people who are actually familiar with clearance work and have relationships with publishers, or even music supervisors, because I think the film supervision world is sort of losing market share as less films are being made, or they don't have as big a budgets as they used to for a music supervisor. And those people are going to be looking for new ways to use their skill sets. And they could be very handy in the video games market. There's a lot of money in the video games market. To me, video games are like the new albums. And last year, we had a song in Just Dance. And Just Dance sold 6 million units in the first 3 months that it was out. I mean, name an album that has sold 6 million units in a year in the last 5 years. I mean, you could count them on your left hand. But video games sell at that level, and they're only going to continue to increase because they go cross-platform. So you have a video game that then becomes a mobile game. And if your song is popular in the video game, chances are you'll be licensed for the app version. So there's so many possibilities for everybody to be very happy working together, making money, and also maximizing the capacity of the game.
And I think to add on that, you know, it seems, though, very basic. I mean, music industry, music publishing, exploitation of sound recording copyrights. I mean, it's been around a long time, the structure, you know, moving forward. You'd think a new medium like the video game industry, well, not new-ish, I guess, would have its act together on something like this, especially when there is large demand and great success with games like Rock Band or Guitar Hero that are very dependent on the music licensing. But one of the cases cited in the materials given to you today, I believe it's called the 4MM case, is there to show a prime example of how video game companies do not have their act together when it comes to music licensing. In that particular case, a video game developer came out with a rock band type-ish game for hip-hop music called Rap Superstar. They were sued by several companies in the music industry, I believe some publishers and some, record labels, because they hadn't properly cleared all of the music licenses in the songs that were being played in the video game. And this is just last year. So we've come a long way in terms of music licensing, but apparently not far enough for it to be realized by the video game industry.
Brian, looking at the last three bullet points, letting somebody decide whether they want to drive a Bentley with a Budweiser in the cup holder while wearing an Aerosmith t-shirt and their Nike basketball shoes. What are some of the pros and cons of licensing real-world brands that game developers would want to be aware of and their lawyers would want to be aware of?
Okay, well, just to start off, there's a threshold question as to whether you want to include real-world brands in your game. Some games are more fanciful than others, even though they're portraying a real-world space, and the inclusion of real brands, hopefully licensed, in your game space, if it's alongside also artificial parody brands, actually might make it harder for you to defend the parodies that are in the game next to actual brands. Think about it this way. If a game includes licensed Adidas sneakers, it's going to be harder for you to defend, your fakey brand sneakers that have, an upside-down check as their logo, because people could be confused by the fact that, there's one actual brand in the game, and then when they kind of don't see another a brand very closely but see it kind of in passing, they may believe that that was also licensed from whatever source is similar to that. So there's a very serious question of whether you should even have them in the game, even though they can add realism. Beyond that, licensing brands isn't fast, and neither is creating in-game assets. So if you're working with a company and they've already made the decision that they want to include real brands in their game, you're going to want to create that list and start tracking down licensors immediately, because they're not the fastest licenses to tie up, and you don't want to be holding up the development of your game or your client's game just because you're getting these licenses, or worse, you don't want your client to go off and start creating the game or creating the in-game assets, assuming they can use the license, and then have to pull all that content out later, because that's just, wasted money, wasted time, and they're going to be looking at you as the attorney to be the one, they're going to think you're the cause of that, even though you're probably not. Third concern you're going to want to be looking at is, generally speaking, brands, both in the real world and in video games, don't like being associated with illegal behavior. So you're not likely to see brands that are very happy with, you in-game finishing off your Coke right after you finished off a shootout with the police and then driving off with your Bentley. They're not going to be 100% comfortable with that, so it might actually be kind of the conversation you have to have with your developers, in that depending on what content or actions they want to have in their game, they may have to just get creative and actually create their own brands and create their own assets rather than relying on real-life branded assets in the game if they're doing more kind of illegal or illicit behaviors in the game. That's one of the reasons you see more real brands in, like, sports games, for instance, because real brands are familiar with and comfortable with being associated with sports brands versus not so comfortable with being associated with car chases and cop shootouts and things like that. So,
but isn't it revenue generating for them?
Yeah, the brands, assuming they go through with the licensing process, they can generate revenue, but it's really kind of if it's not in their main wheelhouse of what they do, does it hurt their brand to be associated with something that may involve violence or may involve harsh language, whereas they can actually, in the alternative, license to like a sports game where they know nobody's going to be shooting anybody in an NBA game. It's kind of, where do you put your marketing budget or where do you focus your attention?
Well, you mean in a virtual NBA game?
In a virtual NBA game, yeah. What's actually happening?
Distinguish from a real NBA game.
Real NBA games.
Is it a different result if the Escalade doesn't have a Cadillac badge, or the soft drink in the cup holder is bug juice, yellow, green, and is depicted as an energy drink?
I would say it's taking just the logo off of something like a Bentley, probably not enough.
Right.
You're going to have to be more fanciful than that, and that's what I'm saying. You're going to want to tell your developers, be creative. It's not enough to just take a logo off of something, particularly something as distinctive as like a Coca-Cola bottle, which they have marks and registrations and protections for their bottle shape. So just maybe changing the color, maybe changing the shape of the bottle a little bit, maybe not using a red banner with a white twist on it, that kind of thing. But using something that's a little more fanciful, tell them, be creative. And really, I mean, it's their job. They're developers, they're creative people. They don't want to be thought of as the not creative people. And it's if they do a good job at it, they can actually be well known for creating their own brands within games. So.
Well, it sounds like one of the takeaways is that the rights clearance phase shouldn't be the first notice that legal gets of real-world references that the game designers would like to work into their game.
Oh,
lawyers need to be involved earlier in the process.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's the clearance of in-game content. It's in-game content is you're creating an entire world, so every single object that's in that world could potentially violate someone's rights in something, be it a crate, a box, a poster. Having a system for in-game legal, the clearance of in-game content is crucial. And actually having a system where, you know, the assets that are being created by the dev team are handed off to somebody in legal so they can see those assets side by side with whatever their real world inspiration is, so they can see kind of, oh, if that's the poster we were inspired by, what does the poster in-game look like? How close are they? Were they creative enough if they weren't actually licensing that object so they could include the in-game asset in the game without triggering any liability or kind of getting a knock on the door from whoever created that poster or created or owns the brand for that soda, that kind of thing. It's a good early warning system, and it's a good back and forth where you don't always have to be the content police and just say no to everything. You can kind of work with them and say, okay, I see what you did with this poster. You should probably change that a little bit more. What if you changed this and this but still kind of kept a lot of the feel or at least the look or a little bit, the elements that you like but not the elements that are protectable, that kind of thing.
Well, let's take a look at another real-world reference that our design team has come up with. Looking for ways to make the game's Kingpin avatar look tougher, GTR's designer wants to add tattoos like this one. And this brings us to the wonderfully esoteric world of the tattoo cases, which asks the question, is the human skin a tangible medium of expression in which a tattoo is fixed? And other interesting questions. So, Emilio, there's a couple cases here I know you want to talk about, yeah. So we'll start with this one.
I'll just begin first with the answer to the question you just posed, and the answer is, I have no idea. I don't think anyone does. But this is, I mean, we could spend an entire presentation on this subject alone.
But we won't.
But we won't. We won't. And there'll be a variety of opinions all over the place. I think everyone here has heard about or remembers this case from about almost 2 years ago where a tattoo artist in Missouri sued Warner Brothers trying to bar the release of the sequel to The Hangover because the character Stu ended up getting a tattoo virtually identical to that the tattoo artist had put on the face of Mike Tyson. What happened in that case? Ultimately, no, there was a decision from the bench denying a temporary injunction, but there wasn't a written opinion on the matter. So we're not really sure what the result was for that case, how that impacts future cases in this realm. But what everyone remembers we really got from it was the famous written declaration from David Nimmer, who was retained by Warner Brothers Studios to serve as the expert witness. And David Nimmer had come up with a number of different theories saying why tattoos should not be subject to copyright protection, one being that the human body is not an appropriate material substrate for the fixation of a tangible, for a work in a tangible medium of expression. You get into the whole, is it a useful article argument or not? Nimmer went as far as to even say that to impose liability on someone for infringement of a tattoo was the equivalent of a involuntary servitude or badge of slavery, violating the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution.
He is Professor Nimmer, after
he
all.
He is Professor Nimmer. But I mean, it does raise a number of issues in here. If a tattoo artist puts a tattoo on you, Does he suddenly control your ability to appear in public? Did you just suddenly violate the public performance right or the public display right? Can you alter that tattoo, make say, a giant sleeve of tattoos on you? Did you just create an unauthorized derivative work? There are arguments about whether or not there's an express or implied license granted from the tattoo artist to the subject. But if you have the tattoo and you allow someone to take a picture of you and that picture ends up wherever out there on the internet, did you just commit contributory copyright infringement? And that was one concern David Nimmer had, and that concern has now made it to the surface.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, let's talk about the video game applications.
This issue, we talk about it because it has entered into the video game realm. One of the first cases is this one here, Escobedo v. THQ Inc., involving the video game UFC Undisputed 3, where you've got this real-life famous UFC fighter with a tattoo on his side. If we go to the next slide, here's a video game representation of him. The tattoo artist sued for that. Basically, it's the Hangover 2 case all over again. Not a film, though, but in a video game. Same issues. But the one case that I was referring to earlier is out of the Western District of Louisiana, where someone has sued football player Ricky Williams for a tattoo he placed on him. And he also sued EA Sports. Because Ricky Williams appeared on the cover of EA Sports NFL Street game, which was actually published in 2004. So there's a limitations issue there. But this is the first time that I've seen where someone has sued not only the game developer or the game publisher, but the individual who had the tattoo on them as well. And the allegation there is not only direct copyright infringement, saying that there was no license, but contributory infringement, because Ricky Williams allowed his image with the tattoo to be displayed on the artwork for the video game.
None of these cases have been decided.
None.
So it's an interesting issue that's going to be resolved, or more likely going to be resolved by settlement. You'll see frequently in these cases that the game development companies wind up settling these cases, perhaps to avoid adverse rulings that are going to be problematic for them. One thought about tattoo art too is if, let's say, a young actress gets a tattoo and then becomes famous, at what point does the tattoo become part of her persona, like an Angelina Jolie, where her right of publicity might come into play in conflict with this? And that brings us to our next, I should have showed you that earlier. That's a very good comparison of those two. Our next slide. In addition to allowing players to choose between several generic-looking cyborgs as avatars, TE's development team thinks it would be cool if one of the avatars looks a lot like this. And that, of course, brings us to an issue which has occupied the courts greatly in the past couple of years, which is right of publicity in the context of video games. As I know, almost all of you probably know, the right of publicity is a creature of statute and common law, depending on the jurisdiction, which purports to protect against the unauthorized commercial exploitation of one's name, likeness, identity, persona. Because exploitation value of a celebrity is going to be greater, typically, not surprisingly, New York and California are the leading jurisdictions in this area. You may recall that the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that a right of publicity under state law can coexist with the First Amendment. That was the Zucchini versus Scripps Howard broadcasting case in 1977. Where the court found that the unlicensed news broadcasts of the human cannonball Hugo Zucchini's entire circus act in a news program violated his right of publicity, and that the First Amendment defense did not defeat that claim. So where these cases have found the most traction are with respect to EA's popular football video games. And the first of those cases was the Keller case. In 2010, Northern District of California. Keller was a class action brought by former Arizona State quarterback Sam Keller over EA's alleged misappropriation of what he called his unique athletic image in its popular NCAA football video game. In NCAA football, if you're not familiar with it, the virtual players are virtually indistinguishable from the real players, and that's by design, because, of course, EA wants it to be a lifelike playing experience. So looking at Keller here, you'll see that the physical appearance is very similar, if not identical. The avatars in the game have the same height, the same weight as the real players. They wear the same jersey numbers. They come from the same home states. They make the same equipment choices. And they even try to imitate their signature playing styles. And if you look at this slide, Sam throwing the football on the left, on the right, there's his avatar. If you notice in his throwing arm, he's got a black wristband, which is what Sam Keller used to like to wear. And if you'll notice on the avatar's other arm, there is a large white armband. And that is also by design, because EA, as part of its product development, actually goes out and interviews the equipment managers for all the college football teams to find out what these players like to wear. You know, do they use a visor? Don't they? You know, what kind of eye blacking? Do they use the paint? Do they use the stickers? Down to that level of duplication. So in this case, EA had brought a Rule 12 motion to dismiss, and that motion was denied by the Northern District Court, and that court applied California's transformative use test, which is based on copyright's fair use defense. And the test, as it was developed by the Comedy 3 case, which was a California Supreme Court case in 2001, applied to right of publicity, asks whether the challenged work contains significant transformative elements or value that does not derive primarily from the celebrity's fame. Descriptions of celebrities amounting to little more than the appropriation of celebrities' economic value are not protected expression under the First Amendment. And importantly, the court goes on to say that the strongest case for a right of publicity claim arises where the work appropriates the very activity by which the entertainer acquired his reputation in the first place. And we're going to see that come up in these decisions. This test is now routine, because it's been adopted in California, and the California courts have developed these cases. This test is now routinely applied in other jurisdictions. In that case, it involved T-shirts which bore a charcoal drawing portrait of the Three Stooges. And the Supreme Court found that a charcoal character of the Three Stooges wasn't transformative enough. It looked just like them. It was obviously put on the T-shirt to make the T-shirt sell. The T-shirt didn't add any value of its own. It wasn't transformative. The Keller court in that case found that the nearly identical appearance of the avatars to the players meant that the game was not transformative enough, and found for the players, or at least found that the players had stated a cause of action. On appeal to the Ninth Circuit, EA has argued that the district court blew the call, if you will, by ignoring the other creative aspects of the game. And there were many, including lifelike stadiums, you know, replica coaches, fight songs, cheerleaders. You know, the whole aura and atmosphere of football games is duplicated with the same degree of exactitude. But the Keller court said, no, it's all about what the players look like. Recently, last year, in a case called Davis versus Electronic Arts, the Northern District, again, different judge, applied the Keller case to EA's very popular Madden NFL football game and reached exactly the same result. Found for the plaintiffs by focusing on the clone-like nature of the avatars, and as that court stated, football players playing football, you know, hearkening to the Comedy 3 standard. And that court also refused to consider other creative elements of the game. And interestingly, in doing so, that court said that if you did consider the other creative elements of the game, you would effectively eviscerate the right of publicity. So at least the Northern District is pretty clear in their feeling about this. One bad fact in the Davis case was that EA had to admit that it had licensed the use of some players' images from the NFL for $35 million. So that was not lost on the court. Those are on appeal. Now, there's another case that comes out of the Northern District in New Jersey, and it's Judge Wolfson, who's the same judge that decided the Tetris decision. And she applies the transformative use test to a suit that's virtually identical to Keller. It was brought by Rutgers quarterback Ryan Hart. It's class action, same drill, same game, same issues. But she reaches an entirely different conclusion. In applying the transformative use test, she notes and admits that the near identical appearance of the avatars and the players is, as she put it, problematic for Electronic Arts. But she nonetheless found that the game was substantially transformative for two distinct reasons. One is that the players, using modes that were available in the game, could change the appearance, players meaning the gamers, could change the appearance of the player avatars. So they weren't etched in stone. The other, which she turned to, was the fact that there's so many other creative elements in the game, the entire environment that surrounds the players. So she said that all of that was transformative enough, and she expressly rejected the Keller court's reasoning. And what she said was, focusing solely on the challenge image as opposed to the work as a whole was inconsistent with the transformative use test. She then went on to apply the Rogers test, which I'll mention briefly, and that's the Second Circuit's test that's derived from trademark principles of misappropriation and false advertising. And as you see, it asks whether the challenge work is wholly unrelated to the underlying work or whether the use of plaintiff's identity is a disguised commercial advertisement. And she easily found that that like the transformative use test, that this test was satisfied as well, and that the use was transformative and thus not infringing on the right of publicity. On the first prong, she held that one cannot reasonably argue that Hart's image is wholly unrelated to a virtual football game. And then on the second prong, she basically held that it's clear from the whole context of the game that there is no implicit endorsement or suggestion of commercial endorsement by the players. So she felt it satisfied both those tests. Unlike Keller and Davis, this is interesting. Hart was decided on a summary judgment motion, so it was therefore decided on an evidentiary record. The California cases were decided on motions to dismiss. So if the Ninth Circuit sides with those courts and remands those cases back for further proceedings, be interesting to see how those courts handle these issues on a full record. Hart is now on appeal to the Third Circuit, so these issues are unresolved. The other case that's a significant case is the No Doubt case. And this is a California appellate case in 2011, again a video game case. This suit arises from the use of avatars resembling the No Doubt band members, including Gwen Stefani, in Activision's very popular Band Hero game. So as you can see, there's Gwen and there is her lifelike avatar. This is an interesting case because in this case there actually was a license. All these other cases are unlicensed uses. In this case, Activision entered into a license agreement with No Doubt band members to use their personas, voices, even their movements to create what were understood to be, you know, lifelike, virtually identical avatars to perform songs in the game. And there were two songs that were delineated in the license agreement which were to be performed. But the license agreement didn't provide for anything else. And I'm guessing that it may be, we know that No Doubt didn't know, and it may be that Activision's lawyers didn't know, that the technical aspects of the game allowed unlocking features to players which would allow the players to do different things with the No Doubt avatars, including causing them to sing songs of other bands, which No Doubt would never sing, causing them to sing separately, causing them to join other groups. They could make Gwen Stefani sing in a male voice and the male band members sing in female voices. So the band took umbrage to those alterations and claimed that those were unauthorized uses. They weren't referenced in the license, and then sued on a right of publicity theory to the extent those other uses were permitted in the game. Activision argued, as EA did in Keller and Davis and Hart, that, hey, we've created this fanciful concert venues, and you know players can make them sing different songs. There's transformative elements to the game. And the No Doubt Court disagreed and sided with the band members. And I want to show you this language because I think it really succinctly describes what the trend is, certainly in California. The No Doubt avatars perform rock songs with the same activity by which the band achieved and maintained its fame. So there's the Comedy 3 issue. Moreover, the avatars perform those songs as literal recreations of the band members. That the avatars can be manipulated to perform at fanciful venues, including outer space, or to sing songs the real-world band would object to singing, or that the avatars appear in the context of a video game that contains many other creative elements, does not transform the avatars into anything other than exact depictions of No Doubt's members doing exactly what they do as celebrities. So you now have four courts that have looked at the transformative use test, applied it to video games, and reached very different conclusions, which does tend to support, I think, the criticism of the transformative use test as applies to right of publicity as being too vague and resulting in subjective and unpredictable results and putting judges in the role of art critics. Given our hypothetical, there's one other case I'd like to mention briefly. Obviously, the hypothetical is a Grand Theft Auto hypothetical, so wouldn't it be great if there was a Grand Theft Auto right of publicity case? Well, of course there is. The California Appellate Court, and this was just a few months ago at the end of 2012, in a case called Washington versus Take-Two. In that case, in 2003, a rapper named Mike Shag Washington, the plaintiff, gave an interview to Rockstar Games about his real-life street gang experiences, and he signed a confidentiality agreement, but no license was obtained. Rockstar then subsequently obtained photographs of Washington from a magazine, and 7 years later, when the game Grand Theft Auto San Andreas is released, Washington's young nephew comes to him and says, "Gee, uncle, there's a character called CJ that looks just like you." So he brings suit, and in the context of that, Rockstar admitted that Washington was one of 100 models that were used for the game. They claimed to have given him a modeling credit, and the court, in looking at this, ruled for Rockstar, finding that there was a transformative use. And these were the factors they looked at. In this case, they said the CJ avatar is not a literal depiction of Washington. So they expressly distinguished the No Doubt case, where there was no question that the avatars were identical representations of the real-life band members. And then the court went on to find that GTA, Grand Theft Auto, contains significant creative elements that have nothing to do with Washington. So they tick through them. They say CJ travels through fictional cities, encountering hundreds of characters, including police, drug dealers, gangsters, family members. They also found it significant that CJ must, quote, confront many social issues, including police corruption, race relations, drug dealing, and gang culture. How that fits in, I'm not quite sure. I will tell you it's important to note the plaintiff's case was incredibly weak. It was essentially just his affidavit. So there was really no evidence, and it was kind of an easy decision to make. The takeaways from these cases, one of them that seems pretty obvious is that avatars that are indistinguishable from the real-life celebrities are, to use the words of Judge Wilson, problematic. Also, games which have a multitude of extra features, settings, other characters, plot lines, alternative outcomes, they're going to be more likely to be considered transformative. Games addressing important social issues, apparently, are potentially transformative, at least in California. And games where a player has the ability to alter the avatar's appearance in a multitude of ways are likely to be deemed to be more transformative. Now, why that should matter, that last factor, I think is an interesting question. If when the game was originally released, the avatar looked just like the celebrity, and then the player can subsequently alter the avatar's appearance, how is it that the right of publicity wasn't violated by the release of the game? I'm not sure that post alteration aspect of it should really matter much. Brian, one question I had for you. No doubt, that's the case where there was a license agreement. You know, Activision did it the right way. They got a license and they got burned anyway. What's the takeaway from that?
Well, I would have to say getting a license is good. That's important. But it's kind of, if you're going to be going the license route and going to be getting a license, it's vital that the person drafting the license actually talk to the people who are making the game, because it's, you'd think it's a given, but it's not. Because it's not enough to say, we'll get the rights to put this person in the game. You have to actually give some specificity to that to make sure that the uses you're planning on making and including in the game are okay with the artist and that you're getting those rights. I mean, no doubt had, specifically Gwen Stefani, had a serious problem with specific songs, I think Aerosmith songs involving drug use and her singing them. If those weren't in the game, there might not have been a lawsuit. But it's really finding out, making sure when you're drafting, you've spoken with the people who are developing the game, or at least their representatives, and gotten a degree of specificity from them enough that you can rely that you've actually gotten an idea of everything the character is going to be doing in the game, everything that users are going to be controlling or selecting about what the users can do in the game, character can do in the game, and then just as kind of a blanket question, is there anything the character is doing in the game that they don't do outside of the game on a regular basis, as in sing in a male's voice if it's a female singer, sing Aerosmith songs if they're in No Doubt, perform separately from their band when they're a band that has been very serious about not performing separately. It's asking these kind of questions about the people developing the game, or to the people developing the game, to make sure you're getting enough background to draft either broadly enough so that you get all possible permissions, but more likely because, you know, agents and attorneys for entertainment being what they are, at least with the specificity to get the uses you know you're going to need. Because it's not just enough to license to say, oh, we're going to include you in the game. That's not enough anymore. It might have been at one point. It's definitely not anymore.
And you really got to ask and drill down because, you know, the designers are going to say, well, what do you mean? Of course you can unlock. You know, of course, all the video games have that. You know, they'll assume you know. And Monica, this is like what you're saying about music uses, too. You know, you have to really understand every way in which a song is going to be used in the game.
Yeah, I mean, some of these requests, I mean, they get really long, and they get confusing. One game I'm working on negotiating now is actually an app called Zaya, which is a creative composition game. It's an amazing piece of product. I mean, it literally allows you to write a song in 5 minutes, and you don't have to have any skill whatsoever. You sing, you can sing a drum part into the microphone and turn it into the sound of a drum. And the reason there's licensing involved is they have 100 works that they're clearing that are derivative works, and they make tracks, so two measure loops of those. So there's like a bass loop, a lead guitar loop, a rhythm guitar loop. It's every part of the song, and then the user can use a part of the work and create their own derivative work. So from a creative standpoint, it's a phenomenal thing. But from a licensing standpoint, I mean, the amount of stuff that happens. Okay, so now you have the derivative work. How is that going to be divided up among people? In Zaya's game platform, when you sign on as a user, you sign over all the publishing of the original elements that you're writing. So you'd be co-publishing a work with basically Zaya. So that part's good because at least it's clean. You know where the newly created part of the work is published. But they could use an element from More Than a Feeling and an element from a Lady Gaga song, and the computer is going to figure out what part of each of those three elements, each song, is divided up to create the new copyright. So, okay, they figured out like a formula that the computer is going to figure out. What my question was is, okay, now what? Are you going to notify me about all these derivative works? Because, you know, 85% of them probably will suck, but 10 to 15% of them might be really good and might be something I might want to exploit in another venue. And what Zaya wants to do is create popular songwriters. So eventually they're going to have their own charting system of the top songwriters. And inevitably, they will help people learn creative composition. But other issues involved, what happens if what's created is actually an adaptation? An adaptation is when somebody comes to you and they've made an arrangement of your song. It's an original arrangement, but really it's the song. And in an adaptation request, we take 100% of the publishing. Under the Zaya formula, that song would be split 56% between me as the original copyright holder and 44% Zaya. And I said, you know, that's kind of not right. If it's an adaptation, we have to come up with a better percentage. And I suggested 80-20, and I'm still waiting to hear back from them. But it's a really complicated publishing conundrum, and they really did their best to try and explain it to everybody. But I had a one-hour conversation on the phone with all the licensing team, and then I had a one-hour demonstration of the game. And when I had the demonstration of the game, that's when I discovered this problem with the adaptations. I really didn't see that. It wasn't mentioned, and the way they described the game, I never would have picked that up.
Which lead?
Z-Y-A. It's Matt Cyrulettic's game.
Which leads us to our last topic, which we can only touch on, which is avatar ownership. So the last issue is GTR is a massive hit. There's a demand for a sequel. GTR 2 is conceptually the same as GTR, but allows for massive multiplayer online gameplay. Each player's ability to design his own avatar is greatly enhanced by the addition of hundreds of preloaded identifying characteristics from which to choose. Literally millions of variations are possible. So online chatter is buzzing now over the look and feel of an end-user customized avatar known as Juggernaut 911. TE wants to take advantage of Juggernaut 911's fast rise in popularity by using the character in its next round of marketing for GTR 2. But as usual, TE doesn't want to pay for a license if it doesn't have to. So TE wants to know, does it need a license from the player who designed Juggernaut 911 using the design features of the game? And in the case of World of Warcraft, for example, there is an extensive menu of features that can be selected from in the game. City of Heroes, again, a very extensive selection of features, such that millions of combinations are possible. So that sort of leads to that esoteric question, at what point does copyright ownership of the avatar transfer from the game designer to the player who builds it from the ground up using hundreds of different possibilities? And do we have time to even talk about that for a minute, or are we pretty much out?
Well, to throw something another thought out there, too, is let's assume that there is some sort of copyright ownership of it or co-ownership of it. Does that open the door that, let's say, I create my own character that looks substantially similar to this Juggernaut 911? Did I, as another player in the game, somehow, that's going to be a massive online player game and visible by others, did I somehow infringe the game just by playing it?
Brian, what do you think?
Well, as I know World of Warcraft does, Activision Blizzard has actually looked into this issue pretty extensively. If you look at the end-user license agreement for World of Warcraft and a lot of popular, large, massively multiplayer online games, you're going to want to draft in sections that say we won't recreate already protectable third-party characters, like for the City of Heroes, you won't create pre-existing superheroes in the game, and you actually police that. So if it's reported to you, you'll delete that character, and for repeated offenses, you might delete the user. You want to be able to have the right to do that. But more importantly, for specifically things that get very popular and were created in the game, you want to have a clause in your end-user license agreement that gives any rights that are created in characters, storylines, weapons, any content that's created in the game by the user, you want to make sure that the ownership of that is held by the company that operates the game, such that if something is created by a user of the game, it is given ownership to the company, such that they're not infringing it when they let other people see it across their network, but also such that if something does become very popular, they can exploit it by creating merchandise for that character or something like that, which has actually happened in the case of World of Warcraft. But yeah, I think those are the important questions you want to be able to make sure you have wrapped up.
Sure. I was about to thank you for having us and ask if anybody had any questions or.
Yeah, people should feel free if we have to go to do so. And I want to thank the panel very much. And if people want to stick around and ask questions.
We will certainly stick around and join you for that.